Welcome to We Are Family. I'm Julia Dennison. On each episode, you get to hear my conversation with celebrities and creatives as they share the beautifully unique, often hilarious, and absolutely fascinating way they live their family lives. This week, we're paying another visit to my interview with Tan France. One of Queer Eye's Fab Five, Tan had become a father just weeks before we spoke. He talked about the challenges around his son's premature birth, his journey with surrogacy, and the kind of dad he hoped to be. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tan France, and to me, family is my entire world. Always has been, always will be, and now, possibly even more so.
Hello, and welcome to We Are Family. I'm here with designer and author Tan France. You will know him as part of the Fab Five. He is, of course, the fashion expert on Queer Eye, and he's now a dad to a newborn baby boy with his husband, Rob. Tan, welcome to We Are Family.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And I'm so thrilled to welcome you to the Club of Parenthood. So tell me about your son.
So my son, his name is Ismael France. He is, in my opinion, a very, very, very special boy. We love him so much. Shall I just start from the start and tell you what the heck happened when we had our baby?
I want to hear the whole story because I know that he spent a few weeks in the NICU and I would love to hear the full story there.
Yeah, sure. So my husband and I were expecting our child on August 28th. We went on a baby moon to Iceland, what would have been eight and a half weeks before his due date. So we thought, oh, we're being totally safe, careful. Like, there's no way he's coming this early. And then I was going to London directly from Iceland for work. And my husband was potentially going to come to London. But I said, oh, just go back home to our home in Salt Lake and just be there just in case. God forbid the baby were to come early. I don't want to risk having you in London for 2 weeks with me. Literally a day later, I got the call. And I was still very much out of it. I was really jet lagged. It was very early. And he said, oh my gosh, he's here, Tan. Wait, who's here, Rob? And he said, your son is here. And I was like, your son here? What do you mean? Anyway, I cried so hard.
Oh,
I
was, my goodness.
I knew how early it was, obviously, because I was counting down the day. So I knew we were just over 7 weeks early. Mm-hmm. And so I cried really hard. I was like, oh my God, how is he? What's wrong? He's so early. There must be something wrong. And Rob said, I don't know. I haven't seen him. And I was like, what on earth are you talking about? You haven't seen him. And he said, I'm literally pulling up to the hospital now. She just had him a few minutes ago. I was like, oh wait, gosh. Why did it take you so long to get there? And he said, it didn't. It took her 13 minutes from the time she started her labor to get in the hospital. He was out. She didn't
even have time to put
a hospital gown on.
Joking.
That's how quickly it happened. I know. And so we don't live close to the hospital that she was going to. We live actually quite far away, a couple of hours away. And so he hadn't seen her yet. And so I was crying. He was crying. We didn't know what was wrong. It was obviously really, really, really stressful. And I was thousands of miles away. And I knew it was going to take me at least a day or so to get home. Anyway, so he got to the hospital, realized that he was well. He FaceTimed me, but it just looked really scary. I couldn't stop crying because it looked terrifying. He had loads of tubes coming out of him, this oxygen mask thing on him.
Oh, and they're so little.
He was 3.4 pounds. Like, he was tiny.
Oh, peanut.
I know. And so it killed me. Thankfully, I was with my family. And so I was with my sister and my mom, and we were all very emotional, trying to figure out what was happening. And then it was just a fight to get home. It took me 2 days to get home.
Oh my God. You must have just felt like, can I teleport myself right now? Like,
I
that
know.
feeling so
I
far
felt
away.
Physically sick. I felt I couldn't sleep. I couldn't think of anything. I was consumed with thoughts of him and Rob. And I was just so glad that Rob was here with him. Gosh, if Rob had been in London also, it would have killed me to think of him being alone.
Anyway,
I made it home 2 days later.
And you went straight to the hospital?
I went straight to the hospital, yeah. Actually, I went to the hotel next to the hospital to shower. I didn't want to have airplane on me when I went to see him. So I knew I needed to shower before I got there. But showered, didn't care about doing my hair. I wore a hat, didn't care about what I was wearing. I wore sweats, it didn't matter. And then, I went to be with my boy. And we were at the hospital every day for at least 7-8 hours a day for the next 3 weeks. And it was beautiful bonding time, it really was. And it was actually interesting learning how to manage a baby. Don't get me wrong, I would not wish anyone's baby on a NICU or the NICU on anyone's baby because it's so stressful. But having that support of showing you what he needs, how often to feed them, what their cues mean, that actually was really helpful. So by the time we got him home 2.5 weeks ago, we felt like we had it, like no concern. Yeah. And that is the case. It felt like, how are people just taking babies home without knowing how to raise them?
That's a really good point. It's like NICU or not, you know, there does feel like there needs to be a little bit more support with new parents because it can feel that way. I felt that way about, I had a C-section. So I got like an extra couple days when you have a C-section. Yeah. And it was a similar thing. Like it was emergency C-section panic. Like, but, you know, I was grateful to have that little bit of extra time in the hospital.
Yeah. Well, in England, I don't know. I don't think this is the case in America, but in England, if you have a natural, regular labor birth, you can go home a couple of hours later. And I just think, how are you sending these poor women home?
Yes.
And not preparing them for, just at least give them a day or so where you help them understand what this looks like, how to change that diaper, how to properly burp them, like all those things. It's important, really important. And I'm married to a pediatric nurse and he still even learned some stuff. So it was really important for us, to have that extra help just because he needs a little more support because he's still so preemie. Mm-hmm. He needs some support. And so, learning from them was invaluable.
Yeah. And so what's it been like now that you're all home together as a family?
Gorgeous. The daytimes are beautiful, sometimes difficult, but beautiful, obviously. Rob and I are two men. And so we don't have the traditional dynamic of man and woman, therefore mom is more responsible for baby. And I'm not saying that I agree with that. I'm saying that that is traditionally how
men, those constructs are not there to kind of fall back on even accidentally.
Yeah. Even if you have the most forward-thinking man, I think the expectation is the primary caregiver is the mom. Whereas obviously we don't have that at all. And so we are both very actively responsible, equally responsible for our child. And so that makes it a little easier. And so managing
that's a really good point.
Managing him in the daytime is actually quite manageable. Ordinarily, we manage to get ourselves together, shower, we get to go to the gym, we cook a meal every day. Not to pat ourselves too much on the backs. I think we're doing a decent job of managing regular life and new baby life.
Yeah.
Nights are hard. Nights are getting easier, but they are still very hard. Those first couple of nights were really difficult. That first night we woke up every hour or so because we had him in our bedroom right next to our bed on my side. And every little noise, I would...
Oh, yes, wake I remember
up.
That.
I couldn't help it.
Oh, yeah.
And he makes this sound constantly. It's him trying to poop or fart or whatever.
Yeah. I know that sound.
It's constant. And so even if he's not crying to be fed or changed, he's still making a lot of sounds. And so,
and then you're up at like, you know, in a flash, kind of like, what's going on?
Yeah. And so that was the first couple of days. And then both of us were having a really hard time in the daytime because nighttime was so hard, we were just out of it. And so we have a bedroom directly across from our room. So instead of him being right next to the bed, we leave our door open and his door ajar.
Okay.
And so now his bed is in there. Oh, his crib is in there. And so we can't hear every night. We hear when he starts to whimper to wake up, but we can't hear all the...
Yeah, but
that's
made
it easier.
Right, that allows you to get a little bit more sleep because I remember that feeling too. I'd wake up and like check that my daughter was breathing. It's like that anxiety of new parenthood is real.
What has been beautiful is the support from my friends or people who aren't necessarily who haven't been my close friends, just people I know who recently had babies and now they've become friends. Because we're all kind of going through it together. There's so many people, as I'm sure you know, within the last year and a half have had their COVID babies. We are one of them.
Yeah.
All of us have had them within the same 6-month-ish period.
Oh,
and
wow.
So having that support from all of these incredible women, they have been able to offer me invaluable tips, and I in turn have been able to give them advice on the kind of things that might help them. And so it's mm-hmm. created this sense of community that I never expected. Of all the things I expected of being a parent, solidifying greater bonds with other parents was not one of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, totally. No, I remember that. And like a whole new set of friends and support network and family, really, you know, found family and everything. So that's yeah. wonderful. So have you and Rob's gotten a sense of what kind of dads that you feel like you are?
I've always known the kind of dad I was going to be, quite honestly. Here are what we expected our roles would be.
Okay.
I'm very South Asian, very, very, very South Asian. I'm very Westernized also, but I lived a very traditional upbringing and I can't remove myself from that, which means that we really instill discipline in our children. And I will expect that of my child. And we're usually stricter parents. I definitely mm-hmm. will be the strict parent. I hope that I will have a wonderful relationship with my child, but I know I will be more strict. And Rob will definitely be the sweet, yes, of course, my dear.
The good cop.
mm-hmm. Yeah. But he will always be, I think, the very sweet one that the kids will go to when they want something that I won't give them.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. I think it's so interesting the point you bring up about like balance, because we talk often at parents about the mental load that moms will often kind of feel like they have to do the majority of parenting, even when they have a dad who's like very willing and able. And I feel like so much of this imbalance starts right at the very beginning from day one.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because you've partnered with Bobby, a formula company, to try and yeah. help change that conversation around how people feed their babies. And I think that's sort of part of that larger conversation too. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So our surrogate wasn't able to pump for us. And so, and we didn't want to use donor milk. We did a lot of research into donor milk, and for us, it just wasn't right for us. And so I'm a formula baby. A couple of my siblings are. My husband's a formula baby. And I feel like I turned out just fine.
I always say that they're going to grow up and eat hot Cheetos anyway. So like, why do we obsess over this?
Absolutely. So obviously I'm in a very interesting position where when we say that we're having a baby, a lot of people have an opinion on how we're having a baby and how we will feed our baby. I want to make it clear to everyone listening, I 100% believe that breast milk is the gold standard. So does Bobby. We all understand that. If mm-hmm. I could breastfeed my child, 100% I would. I can't. Therefore, I need to not be shamed for that.
Yeah.
And so I posted about it. I got 17,000 DMs that day, and almost everyone was filled with such venom.
Are you kidding?
And I think it's because I think they were misunderstanding what I was trying to say with my participation in this campaign. I wasn't saying we don't need to support the mums who are wanting to breastfeed. Of course, they should be given every support they need. We also need to not shame the people who cannot breastfeed their child or give their children breast milk and have to formula feed or choose to formula feed.
Totally. Or choose to. Like, you don't even, it's like, if you want to do it, you know? Like,
I know. And so reading the comments on my post, and it was so, there was a lot of hate, absolutely a lot of hate, but there was also, it didn't bother me because there was also so much love between women, between moms on these comments who were saying, one of them would say, I felt such guilt. I had struggled with this for so many years. And then other women would comment, such beautiful support. There are thousands of comments under that post. If ever you just want to feel like there's some good in the world.
I love that.
And that there is some positivity between mums. Please just look through those DMs. It's actually quite beautiful.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. And I'm so sorry you had to put up with all of that venom and hate. That is just so unfair.
That's okay. It's expected.
Well, and then also, not just with how you're feeding your baby, but also around surrogacy. And I think you've said before that you wish that people understood surrogacy a little bit better yeah. than they seem to on Instagram and some of those comments. What do you kind of like want the world to know about your process and yeah. surrogacy in general?
Well, Julia, you made a really, the part of your question was really important, and not to be condescending, you probably didn't realize why. What would I want the world to know? Mm-hmm. And this, the reason why I'm emphasizing the word world is because it seems the majority of the nasty, nasty comments I get are from people outside of the US who maybe have a very different understanding of what surrogacy is. Mm. I mean, obviously, there are America's America. There's always going to be a lot of angry people. And so we got a lot of Americans too, but the majority of the people were from outside of our country.
Interesting.
By the comments, I know what they think. They believe that I've taken a woman off the street, tied her to my basement radiator, raped her, and then kept her in there until she will have my baby.
Oh, good Lord.
That definitely isn't the case. I did not exploit a poor woman who...
Sorry, I can't laugh.
It's ludicrous.
God, it's
ludicrous. The amount of comments that were saying, this is disgusting what I'm doing to this poor woman who I'm exploiting, I'm using her body. And I just think, this woman wanted to be my surrogate. She didn't need the money. She's already got her own children. She doesn't want more children. She started out being a surrogate for her family member who couldn't have a child and saw the absolute joy it brought this person, and then wanted to do it for more people, wanted to give them the greatest gift in the world.
Of course. Oh, I mean, I do not doubt it. Sounds like such a wonderful relationship that you have with her.
Lovely relationship. And so I just think there's so much confusion about what the process is. There's a surrogacy agency that we use. There are many across America. This one worked well for us because they worked with gay couples a lot. And they could make sure that when we have our baby, that there's enough legal paperwork done to make sure that Rob doesn't have to adopt the baby. Our son is my biological child. So Rob wouldn't have to adopt. He just is the father from day one on the birth certificate. So all those things we researched.
How did you find your surrogate? Talk us through a little bit about how that process happened.
Yeah. So we went through our donor agency, and we loved our donor agency. So they are the Idaho Reproductive Center, and we loved them. And we got a recommendation from somebody else who had used them and had a wonderful experience. And so we started working with this donor center. And they recommended our surrogacy agency, which is called Host of Possibilities. They said very clearly, there are many surrogacy agencies out there. They are not all the same. Your experience is very different with your surrogate, depending on which agency you go with. So we found the surrogacy agency and we told her what we were looking for. We were looking for somebody who wasn't doing it for the money, who had done it before, who can tell us why they're doing it, who we'll have a few meetings with to make sure this is the right person. They're living the life we want them to live. So they're not, they don't drink, they don't smoke. We don't, mm-hmm. Rob and I, I'm Muslim. I don't drink, I don't smoke, neither does Rob. We wanted a life that was conducive to ours. Somebody who we knew would take really good care of our baby, because they are basically the nanny before our baby's born. They're the person who's taking the best care.
Entrusting them with care for your child, obviously.
Yeah. And so we went through the process of trying to explain what we wanted, and then the agency whittling it down to a few, and then working with this one person in particular who knows people who we know through people we know. And so we know that this person's a good, kind, lovely, lovely, lovely woman. And so she, we interviewed a few times, we spoke, we really got to know each other, what our expectations were. And the funny thing is, my biggest concern, Rob's biggest concern when we met with the agency was, what if they try and keep our baby? That's my biggest, biggest concern. That is our biological child, not the surrogates. They are the person who's carrying the child for us, but they don't have a legal right to that baby. And actually, I want to talk about that in just a second and explain how that works. But
of course,
our biggest concern was that this person might decide that they're going to keep the baby. And the funny thing is, the surrogacy agency owner said that's the main thing people ask. And it's the first thing that surrogates say when they sign on. Please make sure that whatever legal paperwork is done, it's clear that we don't want any more children of our own. We've got our own children. We just want to help somebody else. We cannot be stuck with another baby. This is not our baby. And that it was funny to know that both of us were concerned about the thing that wasn't true for either of us.
Oh, right.
So no, I didn't want her to keep our baby. She didn't want to keep our baby.
Yes, right.
She just wanted to help.
Oh, that's lovely.
Anyway, so the important component here, which again, I don't think people understand when they say, well, how does the mother feel? The surrogate isn't technically the mother. The term is gestational carrier. She carried our baby for us, but the egg donor is anonymous. We work with the donor agency to find the kind of donor we want. And this is not a designer baby. It's basically like IVF.
Yeah.
For us, all we wanted was somebody that looked like they could be part of Rob's family. They're from a ranch in Wyoming. We didn't look for somebody who was super tall and had this icon. None of that really mattered. We just wanted it to seem like this person could have been a part of our family. And that's what we got. And so, yeah, the mother is not, the term mother doesn't quite work for this situation.
Right. Gestational carrier. That's the phrase. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's a whole kind of like new kind of language and glossary that you kind of have to learn these terms and everything. But no, it's so very helpful.
Yeah. I'm never upset when somebody asks, oh, what? How is the mother doing? I assume that they're referring to our surrogate.
Right.
But yeah, she's technically not the mother. And the reason why we separate it out is then nobody has a legal right to our baby. Because if, let's say, for example, the surrogate also was the egg donor, that is also her child at that point, mine right. and her child. But when we have a surrogate and a separate egg donor, neither of them are technically the mother.
Right. Got it.
So they have no legal right to take my child away.
Of course. Right. And that's very, must have been felt very reassuring when you had that kind of explained and everything.
Yes. Very reassuring. That was my biggest concern. What if somebody one day decided that they wanted custody of our baby?
Right.
And nobody, I mean, women release eggs every month, or many women release eggs every month. But our donor, it's just a case of she had eggs that she donated, but she'd never had her baby.
Right.
No one.
More about gel coat.
When the fourth round.
Don't you call in the.
Don't touch that dial. That's right, we're still calling it a dial here because it's Emmy season on the awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor, as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers every Thursday starting April 4th as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with the awardist podcast Thursday starting April 4th on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at ew.com/awardist.
So you're very close with your sister.
Yeah.
How did your family and how did Rob's family react to the whole surrogacy process? How's that been in terms of your wider family?
Wonderfully. Rob family, it was a little easier because they understand Western culture, so they know what surrogacy is. But right. my family, my sister absolutely understood, so did my brothers. My mom had never heard of it. So my mom's first language is not English, and she doesn't watch Western TV at all. She's never seen my show. She doesn't watch Western TV at all. And they don't talk about surrogacy in Bollywood. And so she had no idea what I was talking about. So it was a process trying to explain, okay, so this is how it works. And she said, well, is the mother going to have regular contact? No, there's no mother in the traditional sense. And so that kind of conversation was difficult. I mean, she couldn't be happier. She's so excited. And I FaceTime it, not every day. I FaceTime it maybe twice a week just so she can see him. But they've been amazing. Considering how traditional my family is, it has been interesting seeing just how normal it seemed to them and how accepting and loving they've been. Weirdly, they're more excited about him than I've ever seen them be about any of my nieces or nephews.
Oh, that's so sweet.
I think it's because they're not here. Like, we're usually so ingratiated in each other's lives. We all live, or when when I was in England, we all lived within the same block, and we used to see each other every day, and we were our own social circle. We're really close with all of our cousins. Like, there's usually at least 20 people in our home at any given moment. Oh, wow. And so our families are so, so close. We truly believe in the village raising your children.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think that because I'm the only one who's ever left home, I think that they just want to make sure that I still feel their love and support.
Like, you're part of that village.
Yeah.
Do you kind of wish that you did have them, you know, down the block from you? I mean, I can only imagine having that actual village would be a game changer.
Yeah, I actually wanted to bring out a few of them to, not to help raise him, just to feel like I have my family. Here, that's what everyone, that's a luxury that everyone else in my family has experienced, all my nieces and nephews. And I wanted that. Normally, we call it the 40-day period. So the first 40 days, the family who's had the baby usually goes and lives with their parents for 40 days to really get used to life as a parent, to get some support. And so I wanted to bring my family out, my sister, my mom, my sister-in-laws, and my brothers. But because of COVID, they can't come to the US.
Right. So can you talk a little bit about your own childhood and how you see that influencing your experience as a father and how, you know, you want to raise your son and everything?
Yeah. My childhood was lovely, but strict. The only way I can really explain it is the difference between my family and Rob's family. So Rob's family living on a farm, and I know this isn't the white experience in totality, but his experience on a farm in Wyoming or ranch in Wyoming, he's got a lot of siblings. He's got seven siblings. And they were rambunctious. They would play whenever they wanted. They would do whatever they wanted. They would eat whatever they wanted. There were multiple meals available. You could choose from those. If you didn't want your dinner, I mean, I'm not trying to denigrate them, but that's just the way they lived. If you don't want dinner, it's fine. Here's cereal, or here's this other thing. In my culture, Mom made one curry. You will eat that thing for dinner. The discipline of when you are around adults, not from a very, very early age, but from the age of like 4, 5, 6, we absolutely encourage creative play. But when adults are there, when guests are there, you will sit down and behave yourself, or you will go into another room and play, but you will not be disruptive or disrespectful in front of elders. You will never ever, there's no such thing as a clap back, there's no or back chat, whatever you call it. That literally never happened. I've never seen it happen in my family. It would never happen, and it would be shocking if it did. Whereas I see that with my friends and their kids, I'm like, oh my god, I've never seen that happen in my world. Never raised my voice to my parents or even my elder siblings. The hierarchy of siblings is also really important. Your siblings who are older than you, you do not argue with them. You do not fight with them. They are your elders. And so that culture I love very much. And making sure that all of the children together, we want to have multiple children, that they understand that, yes, you can have all the friends in the world, but your priority is your siblings, your family. That I love very much. You will take care of your parents when your parents get old.
That village, right?
Like, yes. That's
sort of,
yes.
You know,
really,
I feel like
important.
In America, Western culture, we get sort of siloed, you know, in our little nuclear families without, you know, helping out the other generations.
Yeah. And disciplining it within family. I mean, I've absolutely disciplined my nieces and nephews, and if my niece or my son did something inappropriate or disrespectful to my siblings and they didn't discipline him, I would be so angry at them. That it's just as much their responsibility to raise my child as it is mine. That's just our culture. And so, but whereas with Rob's family, it's very different. Rob would never ever dream of disciplining his nieces or nephews. That's not a done thing here. And so those kind of things are really important. And that's what my childhood was. I was raised by my aunts and uncles and my parents. My mom worked every hour that God sent. My parents were immigrants. So my siblings helped raise me. So my sister's almost like an aunt or a mother figure. She's 10 years older than me. And then also the cultural aspect of food and language. That is so important to me. I was raised on only Indian and Pakistani food. Pakistan and India used to be the same country, so we have pretty much the same food. So yeah, I was raised on Indian food. That was my first food. Mm-hmm. We would have what my mom would call English food every few weeks, which wasn't ever English food. It was like pizza or Chinese or something like that. But she didn't know the word for the other country, so she just used to call it English food. And so that's what I want for our child. And Rob thankfully appreciates and respects all of it. He's been around my family so much. He's seen how well behaved these kids are and how respectful they are. He's like, I want them to be raised this way. And so I want to teach my children about my food. We want his first two languages to be Urdu, Hindi, and English. And they're the languages that I spoke as my first languages. And so those things are really important to me. I want my child to feel as Asian as possible, even though he's going to be raised in a very white world here, because I don't have family or community here. And Salt Lake, I don't know any other South Asians. I mean, they're bound to be some, but I don't know them personally. And so all those things that were really important to me, family and culture, I need to instill into my child. And thankfully, I have a husband who loves my culture and wants our child to have that also.
How are you thinking about it when you're thinking about raising Ismail? And like, is that, are you thinking about the language you use, about the books you read?
Yeah.
Are we, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is not meant to sound condescending. Obviously, they will understand the gay world because they're going to be raised by two gay parents.
Of course.
So we will have books about gay parents or gay families. However, it's going to be interesting to really make them understand the straight family.
Right.
I thought we need more books on what straight families look like and what a mom means to certain people. And
it's almost like, yeah, you need to kind of prepare him for the questions that other people might ask.
Yeah. However, my only reference point for this is this. Being raised in a Pakistani household, in a Muslim household, a very, very strict community, I had to understand the greater world outside of my immediate community, and I had to respect them for who they were. And so I got to know white people. I got to know what white culture was. I got to know what other cultures were within my local community. I think that there's a way of doing it which makes it so matter of fact. I don't know if you've ever been to Utah, but Utah is quite white. And so all of our friend group here, actually most of our friend group here, is white. And so they will understand what just white, only white families are, as opposed to mixed race families or interracial families. And they will understand what straight families are, because most of our friends are straight. And so I just think they're going to have exposure to those families constantly. They're just going to understand that our family looks a little bit different, but they also will know other gay parents with their children. So I think as long as you expose them to it at a very, very, very young age, which we will, they won't ever know any different. They'll just know that families come in different colors and different makeups, and that's just the way it is. I think if you really belabor the point and really call it out as, well, you don't have this, you don't have a mom, you don't have this, our family is different this way, I think that it's all the way it's communicated. And for me, it's just exposure to those people. And we've talked about this in the greater world over the last year in particular, how diverse is your friend group, so that you understand other cultures and that you take care of some of that racism you might have. That's also important within our world as gay parents, to expose them to other people so they understand that from day one, they always knew what other families looked like. It wasn't just that we were the only version and we were the right version or the wrong version.
Absolutely. So Tan, I feel like I could talk to you for so long. This has been so wonderful. Thanks for chatting with us. And sort of like to sort of end it all, what are your kind of hopes and dreams for your family over the next year?
My hope is that Ismail will continue to be healthy. It's something that it plagues me constantly, and I know that that's the case with every parent, is that I just need him to be healthy, and I pray for it 1,000 times a day. But that we continue to have the children that we want, and that we raise kind, good children that are not that are a counterbalance to so much of the hate that we see in the world. And that's not meant to be the queer eye fluff talk. That really is it. I want my children to be kind and respectful, and to be a space of love in the world, because there's so much discourse in the world.
Yeah, Oh, I love that. What a great way to end. Tan, thank you so much for coming on We Are Family. This has just been such a wonderful chat. I appreciate you so very much. And much love to your family and good luck with new fatherhood.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to my interview with Tan France. Join me next time for some more great discussions about family life today.
Be sure to follow We Are Family on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so you don't miss an episode. And we'd love your feedback. If you could rate this podcast and leave us a review, we'd really appreciate it. You can also find us online at parents.com/WeAreFamilyPodcast. We Are Family is presented by me, Julia Dennison, and produced by Sam Walker. Editing is by Vincent Cascione, and thanks also to the rest of our production team at Pod People, Rachel King, Matt Sav, and Danielle Roth. We'll see you back here next week for more We Are Family.